Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how a seemingly innocent tweet from Elmo led to a national survey on mental health. And we'll find out about an infamous Arizona cold case, including new witness accounts. But first, when the primary election results came in this summer in Pinal County, one current county supervisor, Kevin Cavanaugh, lost his bid for sheriff to another Republican hopeful. But he didn't believe it. He blamed his loss on malfeasance and said he only certified the results under duress. Then the Board of Supervisors, all Republicans, commissioned an audit of the election to prove it was fair. It came back completely clean, but the price tag is now raising some eyebrows this week, $150,000. Jen Fifield with VoteBeat is covering it all, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us more about Kevin Cavanaugh and why he said he didn't believe the results of the primary to begin with.
So Kevin Cavanaugh is a Republican supervisor. They're all Republicans in Pinal County, and he has expressed some distrust for the county recorder, Dana Lewis, in the past, and made claims about the county's elections in the past that turned out to be false as well. And this time, he was running for sheriff. He lost his bid for sheriff 2-1. And after he saw the results, he called me and said, "Hey, I think something looks fishy here because the early votes are lining up with the election day votes. And typically people vote a little bit differently on those. So I think something was up and I think there was fraud."
So how did we get to a point where the Board of Supervisors commissioned this audit?
Well, basically, I mean, they've been hearing these claims, not only in Pinal, in Arizona, across the country for so long, and this is their way of combating it, right? They say, "You know what? You think there's fraud? We will open up our system. We will do an independent audit, hire a law firm to lead it, hire 3 technical experts to take apart the voting machines." It was Cyber Ninjas 2.0 minus the ballot review that took place. They took apart the machines and looked at it. This was Recorder Lewis's, the supervisor's, way of saying this was a fair election.
Okay. So we'll talk more about the results in a minute, but I wonder that because I thought of Cyber Ninjas as well. Like, this isn't the first time we've talked about election audits in Arizona elections. Could anyone, Jen, get a county to do this, to audit its election results if they didn't believe them?
I mean, I guess so. It's up to the county supervisors how they want to spend their money on elections. If part of that money is building public trust through conducting audits, conducting additional audits, additional hand counts, then that's their decision. Whether that impacts public opinion and whether this actually changed the mind of anyone is really, we have no idea.
Right. So I want to ask you about that and the results of this audit. Do you think this might help quell concerns about elections in Pinal County, or at least that is that what officials there are hoping for?
That was what they were hoping for. Now, just to be clear, they found nothing in the audit. They took apart the machines. They looked at the security system. They have this brand new election center. They looked at the tabulators that were being used to count ballots. They looked at everything and found absolutely nothing. But, you know, Pinal County has kind of become this place where it's becoming a little bit more independent. The results are changing a little bit. It's kind of Maricopa County 2.0 in a way, where, you know, the results may swing one way or the other, which is kind of, I think, stirring up a little bit more this distrust in people where they're saying, "Wait, are those really the results that we're seeing here?"
All right. So I want to ask you also this morning, Jen, about another story that you're out with just this morning, along with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. I know you looked at mail-in ballots that are rejected in our state because of mismatched signatures. How often did you find this happens?
Well, this is a very, very small percentage of people. You have your signature flagged about 1% of the time if you're a male voter, and then you have it rejected even fewer percent, about 1.14% of the time in 2022. And so it's about 1,800 voters that had this happen to them because their signature did not match what they had on file for them. So we looked at why that was and who this was affecting.
Okay. So let's talk about who this does affect then. And I want to be clear, we're talking about how election officials are recording required to compare the signature on your mail-in ballot with the electronic signature that the state kind of has on file for every voter. If they don't match, they will reject the ballot. They're required to. This is a process that's been tightened up here and across the country, Jen, in light of the kind of environment, the election denialism that we've seen, right?
Absolutely. The Carrie Lake case here specifically called out the signature verification process and said they were doing it too fast. Trump started the thought on this in 2022, planted the seed on it. And so Stephen Richer, in between 2020, 2022, tried to make changes to make this a more robust process. What we found in our analysis is that then the number of signatures rejected tripled from that time. But what we found is it had more probably to do with the amount of voters that actually fixed the problem. Like I said, you flag it, you give voters a chance to fix it, and not a lot of voters fix the problem compared to 2020.
Okay, so we've made this process more stringent. Voters do have recourse here, but not a lot of them do it. Who is most affected? Like, whose signatures are most likely, did you find, to be rejected?
So we actually sent a letter to all of these voters in a very unique investigation. We also did a data analysis, and we heard back from them that they were a lot of new voters. We saw in the data that this is a lot of people that registered to vote in 2021, 2022, don't have good signatures, good mail written signatures on file. All they have is their driver's license signature that's very messy. It's an electronic signature. And that's kind of the point we wanted to get across, is voters need to know if they're a newer voter, they might just have your driver's license signature that might not be the best one on file. So watch for that and give them your phone number when you fill out your mail ballot this election.
Okay, so a lot of younger voters, a lot of new voters. You talked to some of them. What did they have to say about this?
Oh, they were upset. I mean, a lot of them didn't know, and that's the problem. You know, you try to reach out to people, you ask them to put their phone number, but it might just get lost in the mail. Mm-hmm. It might get lost in a vacation shuffle. And so a lot of them didn't know. Just to be clear, we didn't hear back from a lot of people, and that's part of the problem, right? Mail is not a reliable way to reach voters, and we saw that from our investigation, too.
You also spoke with a lot of experts here, Jen, which I thought was really interesting, about sort of the idea of trying to validate signatures in a quick amount of time or kind of at all in this way, right?
Right. We talked to forensic signature experts. People that do this for a living have a much different process. They're looking at 10 to dozen signatures. They're looking at the type of document signed to validate a signature. But basically, they said with this really sloppy signature on file and a written signature, you can't compare just that. That's not a valid way of doing it.
Interesting. Okay, so final question for you, Jen, here before I let you go. You're talking about two stories here that are about election denialism, right? About this idea that there are lots of questions about how our elections are run and all of the implications, all the fallout from that. We're just a couple of weeks away from Election Day now in Arizona. What are you watching for?
I'm watching for all of this. I mean, that's why we're looking at it. We want to know the truth about things like non-citizen voting. We want to know how often this happens. We want to know why people are having ballots rejected. We want to know why results are looking the way they do, if there's different patterns in the results like that supervisor spotted. Mm-hmm. We want to see them before the election so we can explain to people, this is actually quite normal. This is what happens. And this is the kind of thing that we're watching for that would lead to challenges after this election, and probably will.
Yeah, I'm sure anticipating some challenges coming quickly.
Yes, and it'll happen fast. We'll all be there throughout the holidays for this.
Here we go. Okay. Jen Fifield joining us from VoteBeat. Jen, thanks as always. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
The way we talk about abortion has changed a lot in recent years, since the fall of Roe v. Wade and the political battles that have ensued here and around the country. It used to be that abortion was referred to by Democrats as something that should be safe, legal, and rare.
We can support a woman's right to choose that makes abortion safe, legal, and rare, and reduces the number of abortions.
That's Hillary Clinton talking about it decades ago. But today, the conversation has changed. On the left now, abortion is about fundamental rights, bodily autonomy. Today, you can buy a tote bag that says abortion anytime, anywhere, anyone. So how did we get here? Well, our next guest is here to remind us the rhetoric around abortion has always changed throughout our country's history, and it's always been about politics. Gloria Felt is a longtime abortion advocate. She ran Planned Parenthood in Arizona for 18 years before becoming president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America in 1996. And she told me until the late 1800s, women's health care was largely under the control of midwives, including abortions, though that isn't what they were called.
In the 1800s, in the newspapers of the day, you could purchase by mail order methods to take care of quote unquote women's problems, euphemism for an unplanned pregnancy, medicines to bring on your period.
But then the medical realm became professionalized and the midwives were pushed out. And in 1873, the Postmaster General at the time, Anthony Comstock, pushed through legislation that banned mailing anything designed to prevent contraception or procure an abortion. At the same time, the women's suffrage movement started to take shape. And some of those suffragettes spoke out about the need for women's right to contraception and abortion as well. That included Margaret Sanger.
Margaret was a consummate marketer. And so she began to use the term birth control. She didn't invent it, but she quickly realized it was much more acceptable than talking about sexual freedom.
So it was a way of sort of sanitizing this issue for the
public. Exactly. So by framing it then as a medical need, she was able to enlist the president of the American Medical Association to endorse birth control.
So let's talk about the other terms that have been used over time for abortion, right? Like there's family planning, there's reproductive health. Some of these terms have been used on the right side of the political spectrum as well as the left, right? I wonder, is it always about that same kind of strategy from Margaret Sanger on? Like it's about sanitizing this issue, making it something that can be palatable for the majority of the country?
There's always that tension. There's always that tension because there's always that minority, and it is a minority, but it's a very loud minority that basically doesn't want women to have access to the means to control their own fertility and thus their own destiny. And so there's always that tension between trying to come up with terms that will bring the most people into the story and yet not compromising the ultimate value of it. And I mean, I will tell you, when I was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, I literally got yelled at, not just by people inside Planned Parenthood, but by my colleagues running other reproductive rights organizations. When I would say reproductive rights are human rights, they would yell at me.
Huh.
Like, you can't say that. That's too radical.
It's too radical.
It's one of those things that as I became a student, I guess, of the history and really looked into what was going on and serving women for years and years and years and just seeing women's real life stories. And I wrote a couple of books about it and I began, you know, saying very publicly that reproductive rights have to be civil and human rights.
So this is super interesting because you are one of the people who has caused the more recent shift in the way we talk about abortion and women's health care, right? Like, so I want to kind of fast forward to post Roe v. Wade America, when we have Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton in office, like Democrats who are talking about abortion in a way that should be rare and legal. I remember that term being sort of the way you would talk about these things. And if you look at what's happened today and the big shift that's happened on the left now in a post-Dobbs America, we hear much more, you know, extreme, I guess is the word, language about abortion, like anytime, anywhere. And this framing that you're getting at, right, of abortion as a right, as a human right, as a civil right.
Exactly. Exactly. The problem with Roe v. Wade is that privacy was never a strong enough legal theory. They simply didn't have gender equality cases on which to base Roe v. Wade in 1973. So they used the right to privacy, which again was more palatable to people than saying that it's up to women to decide whether and when they have children, because think of the power and control in that. And the thing about Dobbs is that it finally confronted people. It forced people to face the music. It forced people to really clarify their values. And if you value women, and if you think women should have an equal place in society and in the world from a legal, moral, and ethical perspective, an economic perspective, then you have to level the playing field. And the playing field can't be leveled unless both genders have equal rights to determine their fate.
Take me back, Gloria, to what you mentioned before about being stopped by fellow abortion rights, you know, advocates from calling abortion a human right, you know, 20, 30 years ago. What was the political landscape like at the time? Like, what was the fear?
It was a movement that was mired in defensiveness. Because after Roe v. Wade was decided, people thought, oh, good, we have won everything. We have the right to birth control. We have the right to abortion. We are getting funding for family planning services through the federal government and state governments. There are new and better birth control methods that were coming onto the scene. So there's so much progress that has been made. But the fact is that Dobbs forced people to confront what their true value system was about women.
I want to ask about the role of Black women in this, kind of throughout history, but especially more recently. Like, they have, it sounds like, for longer, talked about abortion as a civil right, reproductive rights as a human right, that kind of thing.
For very good reason, because Black women and women of color in general have often been used as, you know, research subjects. And if you think about women who were enslaved, they didn't have the right to have children with the person they might have loved. Their bodies were owned and controlled by their owners, who often impregnated them against their will. So Black women have really led the way to the understanding that, and in fact coined the term reproductive justice. Reproductive justice being much broader than the right to abortion. It references, you know, you should not only have the right to decide when not to have children, you should also have the right to decide when you have children and with whom.
Let me ask you lastly, Gloria, a political question about today. I wonder how you think about this, because you were talking about this in this way for longer than people wanted you to. So as the left has switched and talked more openly about abortion as a right, about abortion being available to anyone whenever they need it, I wonder, like, is it too far to win elections?
I don't know that I'm hearing that, to be honest with you. The thing is, if you look at the data, the overwhelming majority, like 60%, I think now, of abortions, they're mostly medical abortions, not surgical abortions, and they are typically done under 12 weeks of pregnancy. So I would have to challenge whether my ears are not inured to hearing that. I don't know, because it's so logical to me that it's really not the government's business in any way, shape, or form to be telling people what to do. And it should be a decision that's made by a woman and her family and her doctor, and that nobody wants to have an abortion later in pregnancy. But there are times when it is necessary, and there shouldn't be restrictions on it, because it should not be, you know, you don't want your state legislator, who has no idea about your medical history, to be able to tell you whether you are entitled to have that procedure or not.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is Gloria Felt, co-founder and president of Take the Lead Women and former longtime CEO of Planned Parenthood Arizona, as well as former president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, joining us to talk more about this. Gloria, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how Elmo started a mental health dialogue.
We've really learned more about how Americans prioritize mental health, how they're talking about it, how they want to talk about it.
We'll hear about the survey that came from the Sesame Street character's tweet to fans. But first, it is one of the most infamous unsolved mysteries in Arizona history. On April 10th, 2001, a Scottsdale man named Robert Fisher allegedly murdered his wife and children, blew up the family's house, and then escaped into the wilderness. Fisher has never been seen or heard from again. And while many assume he's been dead for some time, John Walczak isn't convinced. Walczak is the host of two wildly popular true crime podcasts, Missing in Alaska and Missing on 9/11. His shows have attracted millions of listeners to cold cases like Robert Fisher's, and Fisher is the subject of Walczak's latest project, Missing in Arizona. The show has become yet another hit for him, and it's also gotten plenty of scrutiny. In the very first episode, Walczak speaks to a new witness who challenges investigators' timeline of events on the night of Fisher's disappearance, narrowing the window in which he could have escaped. But some have raised questions about Walczak's approach to the story. Among other things, he uses AI to recreate the voice of Robert Fisher.
I'm John Walczak, host of the new podcast, Missing in Arizona.
And I'm Robert Fisher, one of the most wanted men in the world.
We cloned his voice using AI. In 2001,
police say I killed my family.
Three dead bodies, two were children.
He slit the throat of all of them.
First mom, then the kids.
And rigged my house to explode.
In a quiet suburb. This is
For Walczak, challenging the norms of journalism is part of the mission. He's a former print reporter who says podcasting presents an opportunity for a different kind of storytelling. He believes the medium has the potential to engage new audiences and uncover fresh leads in cases like Fisher's. Walczak spoke to the show's Sam Dingman.
There's a moment in the first episode that I would love to ask you about where you say, quote, "Let me speak now to Robert Fisher. I will not give up." Where did that line come from for you, that desire to address him directly and kind of challenge him in that way?
I think Robert Fisher is alive. And I worry, you know, as a journalist and a storyteller, when people hear a line like that, again, it seems kind of like a gimmick, like just a dramatic narrative device. But in truth, I'm speaking directly to Robert Fisher. So I try to appeal to him in different ways. If I'm being honest, I try to goad him in different ways. It's something that I think an investigator would do sitting down at an interview table with him.
Let me ask you about that. How do you think the particularities of podcasting have changed the way that you approach the storytelling?
I think that it's allowed me to tell it however I want. And part of that is that it's audio specific. So it's richer than text and even graphics, and it's not as complicated as film. So it's somewhere in the middle. And in some ways, it's really challenging because you have to hit so many notes. Like, I have to convey the information. Here are the details. Here's the story. I want to be responsible. I want it to be entertaining. I need the audience's help. I'm speaking to Robert Fisher. I'm speaking to the media. And so I think that there are just different languages that get blended together in a podcast.
You're making me think that part of what is going on when podcasting as a medium is criticized is that there is this tendency, I think, to want to fit it into the strictures of another medium. So, for example, to say like, well, it's audio, so it should operate by the same rules as radio. Or to say, well, it's documentary-style storytelling, so it should operate by the same rules as documentary film, when in fact, it's just its own medium that has different rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also takes courageous storytellers and courageous media outlets, because there is such a pressure to conform, especially when you're rising up and you get an opportunity like I had to tell a story with a large partner like iHeartRadio. There is a pressure to play it safe. And I just really don't want to do that. I want to tell a story in a creative and innovative way. And, you know, sometimes we try things and they fail. And people are certainly not shy about letting me know that.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, to this point in our conversation, we've been talking about counters to the argument that some make that podcasts are not, quote unquote, real journalism or real storytelling or whatever, because they're as much about the story as they are about this other deeper human thing, about the pursuit of meaning. But I do think where those criticisms can sometimes have validity is when it comes to questions about using someone else's story to fuel your own sense of adventure and what the implications for family members of the deceased or people who have passed away and don't get a say in whether their story is being told might say about that storytelling. Is that a question you've felt you had to wrestle with?
I think it really comes down to how a storyteller handles it. Of course, I try to handle the family and the friends and the people tied to this case with empathy, but I try to handle Robert Fisher with empathy. I don't condone the actions, but I really just want to look at this person for who they were. I don't want to portray them in this lazy, way as just like this cartoon demon. And, you know, I would say respectfully, certainly not everybody, but I've sat down with dozens of these people. I've discussed many things with them privately. And my fidelity is to the people who graciously shared their stories with me. I try really hard. And so I'm not sure if you're going to ask me about the AI voice, for example, but if you want to, you're welcome to. But
I'm glad you did anticipate my question. What were the conversations around that? How did you make the decision to go ahead and do that?
Yeah, so I want to find Robert Fisher. So what we did is we took every second of Robert Fisher's voice that we have. So what that was is that was me for like a week or two last year combing through a home video that survived the fire in a fire safe and bits and pieces of video that were given to me by family friends, and indexing every single second of Robert Fisher's voice that we have that's out there. And then we worked with this company called Altered AI, and we said, can you recreate Robert Fisher's voice? So we only use it in one episode. And that is an episode in which I interview, in air quotes, AI Robert Fisher about the ethics of recreating his voice. And, you know, from this case perspective as well, unique to this case, one of the big things that people will tell you about Robert Fisher and tying it into other cases of familicide in a broader context, not just Robert Fisher, is that these guys are really obsessed with control. And so in this sense, this is me taking control from Robert Fisher, if he's out there listening, and saying, if you want to speak for yourself, you're welcome to come forward.
So this is part of the broader attempt to kind of goad him directly.
Partially that, partially it was an experiment. I like pushing boundaries with storytelling, with narration, with soundscaping, but especially with the investigation itself.
Right. I mean, the pushback I could imagine somebody giving is it could prompt a certain type of listener who lends perhaps too much credibility to the version of Fisher that you've created to render a false positive. You know what I mean? To think that they have seen actual evidence of Robert Fisher in the wild and falsely accuse somebody or lead investigators on a wild goose chase. Is that something you worry about?
Honestly, no, because I think, you know, it's investigators have gotten thousands of leads over the years. I think that what we're offering is, first off, we're uncovering new information, including pieces of information and details that I know are new to investigators because I've spoken to people that they never spoke to. And second, I think we're also reaching a new generation with this story. And so I think there's this assumption that the Robert Fisher story is so famous, and even in Arizona, that, well, what's the point in more media on it? And I think the honest answer is, if you go ask 20 people on the street of Phoenix today and say, do you know who Robert Fisher is? Maybe two or three of them say yes. So, you know, the other 17 could be right next to Robert Fisher right now in Phoenix and not even recognize that he's there. So I think to attempt to tackle this story in a different way and in a different medium and in a different era and at a different time and for, in part, a different generation, I think has utility. I recognize that this show is a Hail Mary to find Robert Fisher. But as I say in the show, sometimes Hail Marys work.
All right. Well, John Walczak is the host and executive producer of Missing in Arizona from iHeartMedia and Neon 33. John, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Deep in the mountains of southern Arizona, not far from the wine country of Sonoyta, there is a place that's home to a small group of Catholic nuns.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Deep inside came this voice that said, your raison d'etre lies in belonging to me. And that was my call.
Santa Rita Abbey is a picturesque place in the high desert, but the sisters who live a cloistered life there are facing a serious challenge, time. The nuns are aging and fewer women are entering religious life. In today's world, why would they? At least that was the central question for my next guest this morning. Victoria Westover is a producer and director, and her first documentary film focuses on Santa Rita Abbey. It's called Final Vows, and it's being shown at film festivals now. Westover spent 4.5 years documenting the sisters' lives at the Abbey, trying to answer that question. But she wasn't a stranger to Catholicism. She was raised Catholic and went to Catholic school, but today she said you might call her a lapsed Catholic, like so many others. But she told me she always had a fascination with nuns, and that is where our conversation began.
You know, I was a teenager in the 70s when Gloria Steinem was telling me I could be anything I wanted to be, and I had a classmate who wanted to be a nun, and I just didn't understand. And so I think I've always wondered, and when I started this film, I was sort of coming at it from this, I thought, a feminist perspective, you know, like, why would a woman want to become a nun? But I learned quickly that some nuns actually feel that it is a feminist choice for them to become a nun. And,
wow, yeah.
And it sort of did change my perception. I would say that I gained a respect for women who choose to become a nun.
Yeah.
That I didn't have before.
So talk about the way in which you kind of approached making a film like this. Like, you were there for 4.5 years. You must have really invested in this or become invested in it in the process. But how did you get their permission, their trust to kind of do this, right? Like, living a cloistered life, like, they don't live public lives.
No. Yeah, trust is a big issue that you have to establish when you're making any documentary film. But I mean, it's actually kind of funny how it all came about, because I knew that cloistered nuns would not be interested in participating, but I had a colleague who was helping at the film, and she called down there, and they, much to my surprise, they said, yeah, come on down and talk to us.
Huh.
I later found out that, you know, a lot of monasteries are using media now to try to help with recruitment. And so they were thinking, they later shared with me that they were thinking, how do we get a film made about ourselves? and then I appeared. So,
wow.
So their perspective is that we were sent by God to make the film, but
sure.
You know, that
yeah.
was not what was happening on my end. But it was all kind of funny, because I've been a producer for a number of years of documentaries, but I've never directed a film. And I want to direct a film myself. So when I showed up, you know, I said, I've never directed a film, and I'm not Catholic, and no one on the crew is Catholic, and we will need to be in your personal and private spaces, and we'll need to film you for years.
Mm.
So what do you say? I mean, just an absolutely terrible pitch. But they decided to, pun intended, take a leap of faith, and they invited us to start it. But I honestly would say it probably took 2 years of that filming before the relationship really changed and became one of mutual trust.
Interesting. That's
a
long time.
It did take a while.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay, so they felt like you were sent by God. Wow. So tell us about the Santa Rita Abbey. Like, what is life like there? What do we mean when we say cloistered?
Well, I mean, it's beautiful. It's they live very much right in nature. You know, they look out their windows and they see the mountains on both sides. And one of the things, you know, as soon as we get out of the car, each time we go and visit, the thing that just strikes you immediately is the quiet. And, you know, my cell phone doesn't work and I just love it. But the thing that surprised me is, you know, you think that they're just quietly sitting in an abbey and praying all day. It's actually not the case. They are phenomenally busy. They have a very scheduled day and they're constantly working. They have to support themselves. You know, I thought that they would get money from the church, but that's not the case. They're more like a little commune, so that they have to have their own business to provide income.
Right.
So they manufacture for them. They manufacture the hosts that priests use at Mass. And so they have this whole building that's for doing that, and they brought in an oven from France and everything. Everything's mechanized. They do that, and then so it's constantly cutting, baking, packaging, mailing, shipping.
Right, those little wafers that, like, anyone who's been to a Catholic church knows. Yeah,
exactly. And then they're praying 5 times a day, praying and singing in the chapel, and then they maintain the facility. You know, they're constantly cleaning and they're constantly cooking. And so it's really a lot of activity. And then, you know, they also are studying and reading. So, I mean, it's a busy life.
It's a busy life after all. Yeah. So why do they do it? Like, what is the point to them of living this sort of cloistered life, this life that is very separate from the world and very much centered on community, right?
Yes. Well, my understanding, what I came to understand, is that they want a deeper relationship with God. So they need to, you know, they're not really isolated. I mean, there's much more contact than I even imagined. And, you know, every abbess at an abbey gets to determine the level of cloisteredness. So there was one abbey during my research phase that I talked to in Virginia, and they were like, no, we're behind the grill. You can't come in. You know,
wow.
No one goes. You know, it was still like medieval times. But Santa Rita Abbey is not like that. Ended the film with their Jubilee celebration, 50 years of existing. There were like 100 people that showed up that they all knew. So it's not like they're not intending to close themselves off from the world. As a matter of fact, they know a lot about what's going on in the world. That also surprised me.
Wow.
They have a whole table in their library that's full of magazines and newspapers, and they know exactly what's happening in politics and, you know, war and everything. So they are well informed. Mm-hmm. So they're not separated themselves from the world, but they want this close relationship with God.
I want to talk about one of the things that became, it sounds like, a real central message of the film, right? Which is that they're, like so many other communities, they're dwindling. Their numbers are dwindling, right? You had the deaths of three of those nuns just this summer, right?
Exactly. And there's another one now that's in nursing care. So this was the reason they wanted to have a film made about themselves.
Right.
Recruitment is really big on their minds right now, how concerned they are with the lack of more nuns joining them.
And in their old age, living in this small community of them, they're taking care of each other, right? Like, they are serving one another in this really kind of intimate way, it sounds like.
Yes. I mean, we were able to catch some of that intimacy, I think, on camera. You know, we like to say that the film is also a meditation sort of on aging and communal living and how we can care for each other.
I want to ask you lastly, Victoria, about I guess what you learned from these nuns. Like, their lives and the way they live them is so antithetical to everything in today's world, how we live today, right? What do you think we all can learn from them?
Well, you know, there was one scene we were filming when the bishop was saying mass. He said, you know, you are our most countercultural thing that we have, or something. And then that like really struck me. I was like, wow, they are countercultural, you know. So I always thought that I was accepting of different people's lifestyles and things like that. But I had this particular issue, I think, around this one. So I am, you know, I just have a better understanding of why a woman would choose this life. And when you see that these women are so happy about their choice in their life, it really was really eye-opening to see that.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we will leave it there then. That is Victoria Westover, producer and director of the new documentary, Final Vows. It will be released nationally to stream this January. Victoria, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us about the film. It's fascinating.
Oh, thanks for having me as a guest.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Earlier this year, Elmo, yes, that Elmo, the red furry character from Sesame Street, sent out what seemed like an innocuous post on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. Elmo is just checking in. How is everybody doing? As it turns out, his followers were not doing all that well. The message got more than 20,000 replies, many of which described people's mental health challenges. In response, Sesame Workshop partnered with the Harris Poll to get a sense of how people were actually doing. Among the takeaways from the results, a third of parents say their family's well-being is negatively impacted by mental health issues. For families with teens, that rose to half of respondents. When the survey asked what should be prioritized for the future well-being of the country, a majority of respondents said economic stability isn't enough. It needs to be accompanied by investments in education and mental health. Aaron Bisman is Vice President of Audience Development at Sesame Workshop. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, about the survey and what Elmo and his friends may do next. And they started with what the team at Sesame Workshop was expecting when Elmo sent this post back in January.
So the truth is, you know, we didn't have a major expectation in that moment. Elmo tweets many times a week, as many of our characters do. They love connecting with their friends out in the world. You know, they have five generations of fans. And so in some ways, you know, it was a normal post for us. But we saw almost immediately that the response was truly unlike what we would get to any other type of, you know, everyday post.
Yeah, I'm curious what some of those early responses looked like and what they sort of told you about what maybe you could expect beyond that.
Well, unfortunately, many of them right away were not very positive, right? What was positive to us was seeing how comfortable people were to respond to their friend Elmo. And we really think that that's why the responses were so significant and so real. But we saw that, you know, people were really not doing well overall, and that the tweet really helped open up our awareness and the awareness, I think, of much of the country to the mental health crisis going on today.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because it, of course, led you to work on this survey looking at the mental health of people in this country. And I wonder if what you found in that survey, like how much did it correlate with what you saw on social media, people responding to Elmo?
Sure. So the survey that we conducted with the Harris poll, it correlated very closely, but even more importantly, it helped us go much deeper and to establish a first of its kind index on the state of well-being in America. So through it, we've really learned more about how Americans prioritize mental health, how they're talking about it, how they want to talk about it. And all of this information will go into our day-to-day work, continuing to create resources for children and their families. And it becomes a benchmark against which we can measure the state of well-being in the years to come.
I'm curious how it will affect the kind of work that you do, both in terms of maybe the on-air and online product, but also other things that Sesame Workshop does.
Sure. Well, Sesame Workshop has always been grounded in research and focused on impact. And so really the index will allow us to keep a pulse, as we said, on everyday Americans and what's driving well-being today. And so you'll see it show up on the show on Sesame Street, as well as in resources we have on our website in both English and Spanish for children and their families. Beyond that, I think, you know, understanding really the state of well-being helps us ensure that all of the lessons, the guidance, and our curriculum overall is really in touch and providing families with what they need today.
How do you anticipate it showing up on screen? I'm not asking you to give away any secrets here or anything, but like just because Sesame Street appeals to a fairly wide age range, especially, you know, the younger kids, you know, when you're under, let's say, 6 or 7, like a year or so difference is a pretty big difference in terms of development. So how do you try to tackle something as important and as sensitive as mental health when you're dealing with so many different ages and so many different needs and developmental stages of kids?
Sure. So we certainly know, and it's really a bedrock of the show that we have a wide-ranging audience and can speak to so many children. When we talk about bringing emotional well-being into the context of the show, it does not necessarily mean we're speaking about the most extreme or dire situations that children or families might face. The show is for everyone. And we understand also that young children are just beginning to be able to understand, articulate, and name their emotions. And so that's really where the show primarily focuses in this way is with showing and watching the journey of being able to understand one's own emotions, right? Many of us have relearned that Elmo, for all of his lovability and for all the love he has to share, has one major frustration in his life, which is his friend Zoe's pet rock, Rocco. And Elmo versus Rocco was its own social media moment. But underlying that is something really important, is that everybody gets frustrated with things and that can create challenges. And, you know, an important first step is being able to understand how you're feeling and name it, right? And situations like that, seeing characters perhaps exhibiting unexpected emotions is an important part of sharing with the viewers those situations and giving them something to learn from it and respond to.
So do you have plans to do a follow-up survey at some point or to track how what you're doing now based on these initial results is affecting or impacting viewers down the road?
Well, we are always doing testing both on Sesame Street itself and how kids are learning from it and overall in the marketplace. And this new survey with the Harris Poll, we do hope we'll be able to continue on an annual basis and really be able to see the impact not just of our work, but on on so many factors going into the considerations of the well-being of American families today.
How much of a dent do you think an entity like Sesame Workshop can put in the mental health issues that people in this country are dealing with?
Well, I want to be careful not to suggest that we think this is a problem we can solve alone.
Sure.
Or anywhere near. We understand that this is a much bigger problem and challenge than that. But, you know, Sesame's unique ability is the marriage of media and education, right? All of it research-backed. And so we certainly hope that through the show, through educational resources, which are available for free on our website on sesame.org, and through, you know, all kinds of programs we do around the country and around the world, that we can make a meaningful contribution. One really interesting insight that comes out of the survey is that 90% of respondents agree that nurturing kindness in children has a positive ripple effect, building a brave and caring society for generations to come. That is what Sesame Workshop is all about. So hearing that kind of a response certainly gives us hope and optimism that we can be meaningful players in addressing this current situation.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right. That is Aaron Bisman, VP of Audience Development with Sesame Workshop. Aaron, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
For sure.
This is the song, la, 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 Elmo's song. La, 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 la. La 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 la, Elmo's song.
I like it.
La la la, la 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 la.
To think he wrote this alone.
Well, as the parent of young kids, I know this song very well, so enjoy. That'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Be sure to join us again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you heard a song you liked on today's show, obviously this one included, you can follow us on Spotify as well. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app, and you will find our monthly playlist. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.